Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today with environmental justice. A new report from the climate-oriented Boston Green Ribbon Commission finds people of color are most impacted by extreme weather events like heat waves. How the city chooses to fight the warming climate could help alleviate those disparities, or it could make them worse. Here to discuss, Amy Longsworth, director of the Green Ribbon Commission. Also joining us, Michael Curry, who is president of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and one of the founders of the Health Equity Compact. Michael, welcome.
Hey, good to be back with you.
And Amy, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good morning.
So, Amy, I'm going to start with you. As I read the report, here are my big takeaways on it. The unequal impact of environment and climate is real, it is intentional, and as we seek to address it, we have to do it thoughtfully or we could make things worse. Is that basically fair?
I think you got the gist of it, absolutely. I mean, climate, like COVID, which was sort of the wake-up call here, it hits everyone, but the effects of it are harder on neighborhoods where there has been disinvestment over decades and even centuries, where people have less income, less ability to recover, less net worth. Their housing stock may be older, may be more vulnerable, and there's just basically less resilience, both economically and socially and physically, in certain neighborhoods in Boston than there are in others. And those are highly correlated with systemic disinvestment, racist policies, and people of color.
Michael, you're also a member of the National Board of the NAACP. Almost a rhetorical question to you. Anything surprising in what you just heard from Amy Longsworth?
No, not surprising. I think, I've often said, I'm glad so many people are woke and others are waking up, but some of us are insomniacs. And the Boston Green Ribbon Commission, Amy, Embrace Boston, their leadership are insomniacs. They've been raising these issues, right? People are thinking about these issues. Our national NAACP, I chair the National Boards Advocacy and Policy Committee, one of the strongest committees that reports into my committee is the Environmental Justice Committee. They've been raising these issues across the country and across the globe, quite frankly, as they engage the United Nations about the disparate impact of climate change on Black, brown, poor folks across the globe. And this report just really focuses us in on what's happening in our communities, in our state, in our city. I think it's phenomenal, timely, and an important conversation it'll generate and hopefully lead to change.
So we just laid out sort of the three pieces here, Amy. So real, intentional, requires great care going forward. I want to start in the space of real and talk about, as I understand it, this report was the pulling together of a range of reports, right, that have painted a picture, but it's almost hard to see the completeness of the picture until you put them all in. So talk about, like, there are a range of impacts that you talk about. Give us a few of the biggest, not hits like greatest hits, hits like boom, 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 that come out in the report.
Yeah, well, the report is a pulling together of a lot of different research. And while I think our intention was to make something short, digestible, it is not new news, but we have a business audience and an institutional audience at the Green Ribbon Commission. And we want the private sector, along with the city of Boston, to be working together to understand the problem, which is one of the first pieces of climate justice, is to acknowledge that the past exists and it's led us to this point where we have disparate outcomes. So heat is certainly at the top of the list right now for these neighborhoods, because when Climate Ready Boston came out, which was a report we worked on with the city of Boston in 2016, sea level rise was very much the focus. And that has not gone away. And we are going to be dealing with sea level rise. We're going to be dealing with storms. We are dealing with increased rainfall, which is overwhelming our stormwater systems, which is a problem for flooding. But I think immediately, and with summer coming up, the rise in temperatures for a city that has been historically not air-conditioned is really and for an old housing stock, meaning it's leaky. You know, mm-hmm. we're not well insulated, and that works for cold as well as heat. That is a serious health impediment for, as Michael said, vulnerable people, and that includes, I will add, the already ill and the elderly.
So, Amy, you point out in the report a couple of neighborhoods that are particularly impacted by lack of trees, lots of asphalt, poor infrastructure mm-hmm. from a heat sort of, it's not a heat desert, it's a, I can't remember the name of the term, where they're heat-intensive neighborhoods.
Heat Island,
Heat
perhaps.
Island, thank yeah. you. And a couple, Chinatown is one. What are our most intensive Heat Island neighborhoods?
Chinatown, Dorchester, Mattapan.
Those are the three that I remember too.
Yeah. yeah. So you know, East Boston is also a vulnerable neighborhood.
So let's turn to you now, Michael. And I wanted to illustrate the neighborhoods because it is one of the things that comes out in the report is the specific naming of neighborhoods in Boston that have been disinvested in specific ways that lead to environmental impact, right? And then there are these health outcomes. And I want to illustrate for listeners explicitly what the health impacts of disinvestment, redlining, et cetera, are. Illustrate for us three, and I'm imagining asthma is one of them, right?
Yep.
Three negative health impacts that are real for people, especially people of color, because of climate injustice, environmental injustice.
Well, you know, so one, I just want to say phenomenal report. I can tell you I'm a historian, so I dig in often to Boston history, U.S. history, and this report really captures the context for which we have health disparities. And we in public health often don't have the context. There's a highlight in the report of Rebecca Lee Crumpler, who was the first African-American female physician in the country. And she had a quote that I often share. She said, "They seem to forget that there's a cause for every ailment and it might be in their power to remove it." So we're talking about the conditions that Amy just talked about that lead to higher rates of asthma in Dorchester, Roxbury, Mattapan, Lynn, Lawrence, Lowell, Worcester, Springfield. To your point, we're talking about high rates of stroke. I can overwhelm people that almost every disease I can name, almost every disease, every form of cancer, heart disease, diabetes, we are Black, Brown, and immigrant communities suffering at higher rates, living shorter lives, living sicker lives. So we now have in this report a comprehensive way to look at why people are sick that's leading to higher rates of morbidity and mortality across the city, quite frankly, across the country and across the globe. So I think to your point, asthma, of course, it is interesting. I just launched a Health Equity Institute, $6.5 million through ARPA money and MGB. And very soon, we're going to be digging into the root causes of these illnesses. And I feel very confident that they'll tie back to this report and the findings of this report.
I want to pick up an echo from yesterday. You are one of the founders of the Health Equity Compact. We had Bud Williams, who's a state representative from Springfield, on about that compact, some legislation that they've proposed yesterday. Springfield is one of the areas with disproportionately high levels of asthma, kind of connecting the dots. I am going to stay with you a minute longer here, Michael Curry, and we're here with Michael Curry, who's the president of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, a number of other titles, including a member of the board of directors of Embrace Boston, which was one of the participating organizations in creating this report. We also have with us Amy Longsworth, who's the director of the Boston Green Ribbon Commission. We're looking at a report on environmental justice in the city of Boston. Michael, I know the pushback. Climate change affects everybody. Everyone can be harmed about it. There are critics who will say, why does this have to be about race? Climate will affect everyone. Answer the pushback.
Well, it's interesting. We never want anything to be about race. But of course, if you read the report, you understand that it is, that our transportation, where people live, what access they have to resources, what education they've been provided, the academic rigor they had access to, quite frankly, the air they breathe, whether they got city services, all of those things then and now, right? From 1630 and the arrival of those first slaves in 1640 from Bahamas that the report points out, through every phase of our maturation as a city, race has always mattered. And I think to those people who are detractors and says, well, why do you combine the two? We're now using the term intersectionality, right? There is a clear connection between why people are living and dying under those circumstances and us having to address climate change. The other thing that I think is important, the report points out, is that as we start to address this issue, I just came back from Denmark, not even a year ago, looking at clean energy and the movement in Denmark around addressing these issues, and it will leave some people behind. It is happening in other countries that are advancing, and if you're poor, if you're Black, you're brown, you could get left behind, not only in the benefits of switching to clean energy, but also in the economy of clean energy. There's warning signs for us, and we have to heed those.
So I do want to get to the left behind. I want to ask one more question on the past before we go to the future. And Amy, I'm going to turn to you because one of the things that struck me in reading through the report, it's about 28 pages of content. And it is actually a quick read.
Yeah.
But the first half of it is 400 years of history of policy. I was quite surprised that you made that conscious choice to lay out the history of policy for 400 years. And that's this intentional piece. Remember, we said at the top, it's real, it's intentional, and going forward with care or people will continue to be impacted.
I'm so glad you asked this, because the reason that we wrote this report is to understand the past in order to look forward, because we're now at a time when we have all the things we need to look forward and make a change. We have to make a change because climate change demands it. We have to touch every single building in this city. And in 2023, residents and leaders, we have the historical awareness. It's right here. We gathered it together in 28 pages to make anti-racist choices. And we have the technical knowledge to make pro-climate decisions. And with the money coming from the federal government, we now have, we're going to have the wherewithal to make these changes. So it's important to understand the past in order to make better decisions in the future and to go forward with enlightenment. I'm not saying we will make no mistakes. I am sure we will make mistakes as we take on this sort of transformation of Boston again. Just, you know, look at the highway, the urban renewal era. You know, these were big transformational periods during which time there were some very racist policies and other kinds of poor policies
put
in place.
So the destruction of the West End.
Let's understand that. Let's not make the same mistakes. Let's go forward with enlightenment, having understood our past.
So carry that example forward, Michael. Go ahead.
Yeah, and Tiziana, just one quote that I thought was phenomenal that Amy and the team put into the report, and it starts off the document, which is Ibram Kendi, which we all celebrate, is here in Boston. And his quote speaks to your question. And his quote is, "You can't be anti-racist. You can't even understand what it means to be anti-racist if you're not also fighting against climate change. They are interrelated." Powerful way to start the report.
Yeah, thank you, Michael.
So what does that look like, Michael?
Well, I think, you know, the report gives the context, right? So how do we make sure that people have access to clean air? How do we make sure our coastal cities and the folks living in coastal properties are protected and the mitigation strategies are put in place? How do we, I jokingly said when we were in college, I went to McAllister, St. Paul, and all the Black students who were on campus used to sit together. We joke about how we didn't have trees and we didn't have grass in our neighborhoods growing up in housing projects. We didn't really understand the ramifications of that until recently. And this report illuminates what the impacts of that is and have been on our people and our communities. So I think
Heat Islands, for example.
Yeah, very intentional about how we do urban infrastructure, development, investments. I think Amy and her team give us the roadmap for doing that.
So Amy, lay out some of the roadmap that's in the report.
Well, first, I just want to make the point that This transition is for everyone. The report is focusing on the areas that we need to prioritize because they have been historically underinvested, and you've seen the results. But the transition to a post-carbon economy, as it's sometimes called, where we are no longer using fossil fuels, we are no longer emitting carbon into the atmosphere, no longer contributing to climate change, that's for everybody. It's going to create a healthier city across the board, not only in these neighborhoods.
I understand that, but there are costs associated with that.
Yes.
And that's therein lies the rub, right? Because if you are historically disinvested in, you have less resources available to you
Absolutely.
To carry the cost burden of the investment required to make those transitions.
No, I have no argument with that. And I think to answer your question, one of the first things to do is to prioritize the vulnerable neighborhoods. So if we are going to start to look at distributed energy resources, if we're going to start to look at coastal, you know, resilience from water that's either coming from the coast or that's coming because of too much rain and our stormwater systems are overwhelmed, prioritize those neighborhoods. And with the leadership of Mayor Wu and her team at the city, that's now starting to happen. There is a lot of work to be done in Boston.
And I would say we just did that through COVID, right? The problem of COVID was for all of us. But of course, we understood that certain communities were closer to the disease and closer to infection. So the reality is we've modeled what this looks like. We can do it here as well.
So a couple of the key recommendations, Amy.
Are to, first of all, acknowledge that climate justice is a priority. We are definitely recommending that that a climate justice scorecard be created so we can track our progress. We would target resilience investments to the vulnerable neighborhoods. And, you know, Climate Ready Boston and its subsequent five neighborhood plans that the city did targeted more than 100 projects that need to be done for true resilience to sea level rise in the city. Let's prioritize the neighborhoods that are the most vulnerable and have been under. And there are a lot of co-benefits you can do along the way. If you're going into a neighborhood and you're changing the infrastructure, you're building green or gray protection against sea level rise, you're in that neighborhood, you're digging things up, you're constructing. There are a lot of other things that can be done at the same time. So let's not just do just resilience or just mitigation. Let's do everything all at once in a comprehensive way, which leads to, I think, the need for more comprehensive planning in the city, which I think is something that, again, that the mayor is very interested in. Let's target residential retrofits, meaning what does a retrofit mean? Well, it means that your walls are no longer leaking, your windows fit well so they are not leaking, your roof is in good shape and it's reflective of the heat, and hopefully it's a time to put in heat pumps. Electric heat pumps, and those will provide heating without fossil fuels for the heat, but they will also provide air conditioning.
So, Michael Curry, I'll turn to you. 30 seconds here. It seems to me there's a chance for integration and pattern learning here. I'm thinking about the Health Equity Compact and the proposals around data collection there. How do we make sure, as we're pushing on multiple fronts, that we're learning across multiple fronts? For 30 seconds.
Yeah, so I think that the conversation started just this week. We hosted a town hall conversation in the northeast of part of the state, including Boston, around health equity. And we're asking for equity in all things, right? I think we're adding to that climate justice and attention to clean energy in all things. They're all interrelated, but we have to have the conversation. And as the report plan states, everything needs to start with that, and then we make the right decisions.
All right. Michael Curry is president of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers and on the board of Embrace Boston. Amy Longsworth is director of the Boston Green Ribbon Commission. Great conversation. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Let's get ready to rumble!
In the battle of the self-driving vacuum cleaners, we have Bedford-based iRobot. And the same corner of Massachusetts, there's Needham-based Shark Ninja. The two companies are jostling to be leaders in the high-tech appliance industry. And iRobot just notched a big win. Okay, it was a medium win against Shark Ninja, but these marquee companies in Boston's industry are working through a tough economic climate. The battles matter, just like everyone else is working through a tough economic climate. And their intellectual property matters. So who really winds up on top in all of this. Here with us as part of our regular segment, Tech Talk, Boston Globe technology writer Hiawatha Bray. Hey, welcome back.
Glad to be here. And who ends up on top? It could be Amazon. So, yeah.
Right, exactly.
So we got to... You gotta know, Jeff Bezos, he's in the middle of everything.
He seems to be. All right, so I want to start. So what is going on here is kind of an intellectual property fight, right?
Oh, it's a mess. It's a mess because Shark Ninja is the name of the company. They started out in Canada. They have since moved their headquarters down to Needham, like you said, but they're actually owned by a company in China.
Because, of course.
Yeah, exactly. Well, not of course, but they have a lot of their stuff made in China, as did iRobot, though they have been systematically moving out of China ever since the Trump administration and all the sanctions. I think most of their stuff is now in Malaysia. But in any case, iRobot totally—they first invented this market segment, and they have earned an undying place in technology history. iRobot was the first company anywhere in the world to build a robot that consumers would want to go out and buy.
Early 2000s.
That's right. Early 2000s, the original Roomba was the first successful consumer robot, and nobody will ever take that away from them. But Shark Ninja has been taking away a lot of market share. And iRobot claims that it's largely because they have been stealing their intellectual property. And so over the years, they have filed multiple patent lawsuits, some of which are still pending. But so far, for the most part, iRobot has lost a lot of these patent lawsuits. In some cases, the patents were even held to be invalid. So iRobot had real trouble. So what they did was they hit the panic button. Well, that's not fair. Let's call it the panic button. They took another route. They decided to sue at the International Trade Court, which is a very different thing. If you can convince the International Trade Court that your patent is being violated, they will issue an injunction telling a company that they cannot import any device that contains a violation of the patent. And so finally, recently, iRobot won one. The International Trade Court looked at a bunch of their patents and basically rejected most of them, but then said, this
is
one patent they violated. And so now iRobot can say that Shark Ninja can no longer import, I forget the official name of the product, but it was one of their products. And Shark Ninja came back and said, yeah, so we stopped using that technology. We stopped using that technology in that product. It is no longer there. We redesigned it to make sure nothing we had would violate your patents. So in effect, iRobot won this Pyrrhic victory. It's like when, what's her name? Was it? She lost that lawsuit and they made her pay a dollar?
Oh, I don't know. Oh, right. Okay.
They made her pay a dollar, and so that's what this is.
So here's why I found this interesting. At first it was interesting. I'm like, oh, right. Big lawsuit. Turns out it's kind of a nothing burger.
It's kind of a nothing burger in terms of its impact.
What was interesting to me is this is robotics. It's Bedford. It's Needham. These are companies that really matter. They're local here,
yep.
And they're playing on a global landscape.
We are right here, one of the world centers. I don't know, you could argue about whether we are the world center, but we are one of the world centers for robotics. Absolutely. No doubt about it. And, you know, of course, that's a lot of it. Ironically, a lot of it has to do with Amazon. Amazon actually helped because they came in and bought this local company called Kiva Systems that was making robots that they were using in their warehouses. And people were horrified because a lot of other companies use Kiva robots. And so bunch of people who worked at Kiva said, we need to start another robot company so people can get these even if Amazon won't sell them to them. And other companies, there was one case of a company that owned warehouses, and they said, we can't rely on these guys. We got to start building our own robots. And within like 5 or 6 years, this city had something like 6 or 7 different robot manufacturers making logistics robots. These are the robots that pick up boxes and move stuff around. They are the most unsexy, the most boring area of robotics. Everybody is rushing to get into this business because the money is insane.
And it's here.
And it's mostly here. It's incredible. Six River Systems, Locus, Vecna, Amazon has kept its robot business here. Amazon Robotics is here. Right Hand Robotics. Boston Dynamics, the ones who make the robots that walk around on legs. Last year, they started making warehouse robots because they realized that's where the money was. So you got Boston Dynamics doing all this stuff. It's absolutely incredible. Yesterday, Walmart announced that by 2026, 65% of their stores are going to be at least partially automated. That means robots all over the place. And a lot of those robots are probably going to be made by local companies. It's amazing. We've got a bunch of robot companies here. There's one called Lert and another one called Takeoff. And they are the robots, like if you go to a store to do a pickup, you've ordered the merchandise and you're just going to go there and pick it up. In many stores, there's going to be a robot in the back room that's picking out the merchandise that you ordered and dropping it into a bin so that you can come get it. And these local companies, Lert and Takeoff, make those kinds of robots. And so does Berkshire Grey, I think. Berkshire Grey, which just got acquired by SoftBank. last week. They've been having some financial troubles, but they are in this business as well. And SoftBank, the big Japanese company, is now buying them out. So this is huge.
So this is the next piece of this. And you talked about Jeff Bezos and Amazon at the beginning. And now we come full circle back to iRobot, right?
Right.
Because the other thing that's going on is Amazon wants to buy iRobot. Bedford-based company,
absolutely,
founded here,
yep,
by Colin Angle, but both here in the United States and in the UK. So here, the Fair Trade Commission in the UK, the Competition and Markets Authority are both saying, hey, maybe not so fast.
Yeah, that is a real issue because, you know, and this is another one of those cases here in the United States where what you're seeing is a difference between previous administrations and the Biden administration. Up until, like, for the last 40 or so years, the famous American jurist Robert Bork came up with a view of antitrust that has basically been locked in U.S. law, which is you can't really punish a company for being big just because they're big. The only question is what they're doing hurting consumers? If it isn't, let them go. That's the rule we've had up to now. The current administration, like people like Lina Khan, who's in charge of the FTC, she says bigness in itself is something we should be suspicious of. And so when a company gets too big, we need to step in. That's why, for example, they are trying to stop which company is it? Meta, from buying another software company that they wanted to build as part of their VR and metaverse initiative. They just don't want them to dominate the metaverse by
they're
simply going out and buying
of the size.
Right. And so now they're saying, we don't think Amazon should be allowed to go out and just buy another robot company because it will make them all the bigger. In addition, iRobot's robots are designed to collect huge amounts of data about the houses in which they work. They're terrified about the potential privacy implications. Amazon already knows almost everything there is to know about us. Suppose they also know what our houses look like. They're going to have robots that are going to be inside our houses mapping everything in them.
And you have said in the past that you feel it's time for a level of privacy law that we don't have here.
Absolutely.
And
that's
States
one of the biggest problems in America. And that's like it ties into TikTok. Do you really want to ban TikTok? That's not really the issue. The issue is we allow all sorts of companies to collect insane amounts of data. And whether they're Chinese or American isn't necessarily a big deal. So we can either ban them from collecting the data or, which I think is more likely, we can set extremely tight restrictions on what they can do with whatever data that they collect. We want them to collect some of this data because it lets them deliver a lot of really cool services to us. But should they be allowed to sell it to other companies? I don't know. I think that's a real problem. And we need tougher laws on that. And that is one, but that's one of the other reasons why people are nervous about Amazon.
So that's how we get, listener, from Needham and Bedford in a rumble over a patent all the way to Amazon and iRobot and privacy. But now we're going to shift gears for a minute because I think this other one's pretty fascinating too. Let me give you a little sound here. You're cracking up, aren't you? I hate it. I hate it. But if you're a certain age, you might remember that sound vividly. But here's what you might be less familiar with.
Welcome. This is the first of two videotapes on the subject of Ethernet. All of the material comes from a paper published in the Communications of the ACM in July 76. Okay, now we'll go and we'll look at the slides and you will find what the Ethernet's about.
It's Bob Metcalf. Well-known Boston area writer, venture capitalist. He's also known as one of the fathers of the Ethernet, and he just won the 2023 Turing Award. It's akin to the Nobel Prize. There's $1 million associated with us. Tell us about the prize, Bob Metcalf. How big of a deal is this?
Well, it's a very big deal. The only people who win the Turing Prize are, well, it's all you have to do is think of its name. Alan Turing is considered one of the inventors of computing, the British mathematician who helped crack German codes during World War II, a legendary computer scientist, one of the first computer scientists. And people like, for example, Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the World Wide Web, is a previous winner. Marvin Minsky, who basically invented the whole science of artificial intelligence, is a previous winner. And so now Bob Metcalf is in that exalted company because he was the guy who figured out a really good way to connect computers to each other using a piece of wire, which now seems second nature to us. But believe me, back in the 1970s, nobody had any idea how to do it. And he and his colleagues figured this out. They were working at a place which once was legendary. It was at Xerox Corporation in a laboratory, the Palo Alto Research Institute. That was the
place.
That
was called Park,
It was called Park.
Like that?
It was the home. That was where they invented the laser printer. That was where they invented the graphical user interface where you point and click on the screen. That
the
was
old in, GUI.
The GUI was invented there. That was where some people would say the Xerox Alto was the first true personal computer. They built that there, and they invented Ethernet there. And he is one of his colleagues, I believe his name is David Boggs, I think his name is.
The late David Boggs.
The late David Boggs figured this out. What they basically did was figure out a way so that if there was a problem on the network would automatically self-correct, so that if a packet of data was sent and it didn't get through, it would know the packet didn't get through, it would wait a random period of time and resend it. And that sounds really simple, but figuring out how to do it and making it work was incredibly complicated, but it did work. They came up with this really efficient way that was relatively cheap and simple to let these things talk to each other. They were up against IBM, which that might not mean anything nowadays because IBM is just another company. In the 1970s, IBM was one of the most massive, powerful institutions on Earth. They had their own version for the same technology. It was called Token Ring. Nobody even remembers it anymore because it was designed to work on IBM equipment. Ethernet was designed to work on anybody's equipment.
And today, the reason that computers inside a building in a company can talk to each other is because of what Metcalfe and Boggs did.
Absolutely. And we just take it for granted. The idea that your computer should be able to talk to any other computer. It's not all Ethernet anymore, of course, because you also have Wi-Fi and other things. But they were the ones to crack the code and say, here's how you make two computers talk to each other easily, by just plugging something in.
And have you had any comments from Metcalfe? Have you been in touch with him?
Well, of course. He's thrilled. I wrote about it. He said, you know, this is a great honor. It's $1 million, and he's still going strong. He has, he's back on the faculty at MIT now. He's been on the faculty of University of Texas for a long time. He used to be a columnist. He was famous. He made some weird prediction when he was the editor of Computer World. It didn't come true. He promised that he would put his column in a blender, mix it up and drink it. And he did. And I think it was at a major computer convention. And he got up and did it. He's a strange, funny, wonderful human being.
All right. Hiawatha Bray, tech writer for the Boston Globe. Always enjoy Tech Talk with you. Thank you so much.
It's always fun.
How do you want to be remembered? When it comes to Isabella Stewart Gardner, it's a bit of a complicated question. She froze an entire museum of her life in time, but the details of that life in the 100 years since her death have also been carefully curated. Now a new fictional account of her story presents her, let's say, more fully. Here to talk more about that as part of our local authors series is Emily Franklin, the author of the upcoming novel, The Lioness of Boston, which it releases on April 11th. Emily joins us here in Studio 2 now. Welcome, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
So, so I'm reading the book, and I'm actually thinking, okay, is this fiction, or is this a fuller telling of who she really was? Do you know what I mean?
I do. I think I tried to stay very true to the backbone of her life, so history unfolds as it unfolded. The time frame is how it happened. But in terms of my lens for this novel, I really felt that she was a feminist before feminism. She was and became a celebrity before celebrity culture. And she was an outcast who really triumphed over her misfit position in life. And so I had to have a little bit of fictional allowance as I was writing. And so she was friends with, you know, Henry James and John Singer Sargent and all of these famous artists and writers. But like the dialogue and the letters that are in the novel are my own creation.
So there's a whole bunch you got to there, and the friendships, the intellectual life of Boston at the time, the history of Boston at the time. We are going to get to that in a minute. And I'm going to say right now, I am not going to shy away from some spoilers. However, none of them will be spoilers that make the book not worth reading, right? And one of the things that really struck me, I've heard of this book being sort of referred to as a feminist retelling. I didn't feel that way. She was a feminist,
yes,
right?
Yes.
At a time when she wasn't supposed to be. And so it didn't feel like a feminist retelling. It felt like a telling of a feminist.
Right. I was trying to shine a spotlight on her and figure out, we all know the biggest spoiler is she wound up opening a museum. So
Not a spoiler. You can walk
we
down
know
there
that.
Today.
But how did she get there? And what was her vision? And what obstacles were in her way? And so defying what people expect of you is a feminist action. And she did that in many ways, even though it came at a personal cost. And, you know, she suffered a bunch of personal tragedy and really overcame that and tapped into her intellectual life and herself. And in doing so, perpetuated more of the feminist, you know, she would not probably call it an agenda, but it was certainly something that was a through line as I wrote this novel.
Yeah, it didn't feel like a feminist agenda. It felt like a middle finger between her and a Boston society that just did not want her to have a brain.
Right. Well, I think Boston then and sometimes now can be a pretty impenetrable place. I think when she was 20 years old, she moved here. She was new.
From New York.
From New York. She was certainly born into privilege, and there were expectations that she would be welcome into high society in Boston. But Boston really did not welcome her, and she then had to figure out what was she doing with her days if she was shunned, you know, from all of the social events, what was she to do? And then when you add on top of that some personal losses that she, you know, had later on in her life, in her early life, in her motherhood, she had to figure out what her life's purpose was.
Were there any relationships in here in this book? And again, we're speaking with Emily Franklin. The book is coming out April 11th. It's The Lioness of Boston. It's a fictionalized version of the life of Isabella Stewart Gardner.
Yes.
Anything that's pure fiction?
So I'm sure there are things that are pure fiction because it is, you know, it's a fiction, but, you know, it's fiction. It's not a biography. But for example, Isabella Stewart Gardner in this novel goes to the first Impressionist exhibit in Paris. Now, the exhibit unfolds on the page the way that it did in real life, although with my artistic, you know, vision of that. But it happened in Paris. This is an incredible group of artists, including, you know, Bertha Morisot and Renoir and Monet and Manet and Pissarro. Now, Isabella Stewart Gardner was in Paris at the time. She didn't actually attend that exhibit. But I had her there because it furthers, again, as one has to do writing a novel, how she was moving through her life and becoming more independent and seeing other women, other artists doing their own thing. How could she do that in her life? So I wanted both to sort of show this scene unfolding in front of her and show her able to connect with other artists and coming away from that exhibit thinking, what would she do? What was her role? And also eliminating the fact that of that group of artists, Bertha Morisot is the least well-known. And
yeah,
she was the only woman.
Not
at
one
that
I had heard of.
Exactly.
Before
and she was the only
the
woman
story.
There. But she's actually featured in so many amazing museums in this country and other places.
Okay. So I want to kind of touch on three things that come through the story now and that I think will kind of penetrate our awareness of this Isabella Stewart Gardner who has been preserved and curated. So, what's fascinating about reading a book of her as a woman? She is so synonymous with a carefully cared for institution, a building that she's the one that said, if this piece of paper was on the table this way, it stays on the table this way mm-hmm. in perpetuity. And in fact, you've got stuff at the beginning of the book of her saying, oh no, I said the picture stays on the table this way,
right.
So it stays on the table right. this way, because she fought so hard to get the picture on the table in the first place, right?
Yes.
So it is an act of defiance in the book that the museum is preserved so carefully the way that it famously is now. And yet, part of what is fascinating about reading a book about her whole life is she can be separated from the institution. She can have sex. She can bleed. She can be mad. She can cry. She can miscarry. She can cheat on her husband. She can do all these things that a person can do that a building can't. And I wonder how that spoke to you. That separated her from the institution for me.
Yes. I mean, we are familiar with the building and the courtyard and this incredible collection of art. And many people maybe only know the museum from the heist, from what was taken from it. And if they can learn anything through that, it's these empty frames that hang there. And I think, you know, my take on that is she wanted to preserve this space because it shows who people really are and memory. And so part of what I was doing in the novel was really exploring the idea of memory and what we keep with us, how will we be remembered, and all of those things. And in terms of, you know, giving her life on the page, we think of these historic figures as just a textbook or a building or a black and white photograph in a bustle and top hat or, you know. But she did. You know, of course, she loved people. She cried. She was really hurt. She was rejected. She had sex. She was a mother. She was a friend. She, all those things. And so I really wanted to give that life on the pages of The Lioness of Boston.
So I'm going to ask you to read a little bit of a passage now. And we picked this passage for two different reasons. But this is... from somewhere sort of mid-book, and it's she and her husband, and they're witnessing a major historic event. So let me just have you read this little bit.
Jack was by my side as the Boston streets seemed to explode with color. We rushed in our bedclothes to the bay windows in the living room. Below, on the street, were throngs of cattle, masses of people shouting. Down the street, I could see flames licking a few mansard rooftops with their sloping sides. The fireboxes, I said. The squat red boxes perched cheerfully in various places in the city. Jackie had liked to hold my hand and go around them. There must not be anyone with a key, Jack whispered in horror. They kept the fireboxes locked, giving only certain citizens keys. It had seemed reasonable. Where are the water horses? Jack placed his hands on the window, shocked. I read earlier this week they're ill. Epizootic flu, the paper said. I stood on tiptoe and then climbed onto a chair and could see farther away an entire block of flame, the reflection rippling in the river. We'll be like Chicago, I said, as I noticed people coming out of their houses to spectate. Jack turned to me. It will be one for the books.
So it was striking, of course, when I read it, because we had already booked a segment that we wound up doing yesterday on the Great Boston Fire of 1872, a fire that I didn't know about and you captured in this book. I use it, though, as representation of a time in history that I did not understand was so rich. And I've read, I mean, I've been doing tons of reading about the 1800s in Boston across a ton of nonfiction books on Radio Boston over the last couple of years. But there was something about the story you tell and the way she collects people.
Yes. Well, she was a misfit. And I think what struck me even as a teenager when I visited the museum actually 2 weeks before the heist and was very haunted by her, and I think that's one of the reasons I chose to write this novel, is that she was a misfit who collected other misfits. And so I was really taken with the idea that she created sort of a found family in many ways. And she was surrounded by Boston becoming Boston as she is becoming herself. And so we've got the Boston Symphony Orchestra starting. We've got the Swan Boats opening. We've got Mass General Hospital. We've got Harvard Medical School moving from Back Bay to Cambridge. We have so much happening. And she's becoming friends with Charles Eliot Norton, who became the first professor of art history. All of these things happening at the same time. And crossing paths with Longfellow and...
Yes, the intellectual life of the city and the region that you lay out. I didn't put it together how much of the intellectual heartbeat, not only of the region, but of the country was pulsing here at the time. Talk about that a little bit.
Right. Well, I mean, one of her neighbors was Julia Ward Howe, you know, who wrote Battle Hymn of the Republic. She becomes friends with Julia and her daughter, Maud. Maud's father, you know, helped found Perkins School for the Blind. I mean, there's just so much happening in Boston and so much artistic life. Oscar Wilde is coming through. He's giving lectures. So many people were gathering for luncheons or meeting in various lecture halls, and she begins to host lectures at her Beacon Street house where she lived before she moved to what is now the Gardner Museum.
Okay, so I have to confess, and we are speaking with Emily Franklin. The book is The Lioness of Boston. It comes out on April 11th. It is a fictionalized telling of the life of Isabella Stewart Gardner. I am so distracted by something you said a minute ago, I'm almost having trouble having the conversation. You said you were at the museum 2 weeks before the theft.
I was. I was a senior in high school, and I took an art history class, and we went, and we had to write a paper while sitting in the museum. It was actually a week and a half. I know exactly when it was. It was the Wednesday, the week before the heist on the 18th, and I wrote my paper in the Dutch room. And so I was haunted both being there because I used to go there as a kid and be I was just in awe of the courtyard and this idea that you could collect chairs and paintings and sculptures. I had never seen anything
like
it.
Which she did.
And she kept them right there. But after that, after the heist, I was really, I would say, haunted by these empty frames that were right where I was sitting. I wrote my paper on Storm of the Sea of Galilee, and that's gone, and we don't know what happened to it. But I'm more fascinated with the idea that that grief, that memory, is still there. So we have the memory of the art that was there. We can read about that picture, but we can't see it anymore. But we can see where it was.
Where it was.
And we can see who collected it and who decided to put it there. And so there's so many layers to her vision of art and meaning and memory and artists and collecting. And she collected people and she collected things.
Is that why you wrote the book?
I think so. I think as a writer, I'm very focused on memory and it's something that I keep coming back to, you know, what do we keep and what do we let go of, both as we walk through this life and after we're gone.
So what else did you learn about women, women of the time, art of the time?
I learned, you know, certainly at the beginning of this novel, there's some scenes with the Mean Society girls. That's always been the case.
I mean, it is right out of Mean Girls.
It
sure really is,
except with less comfortable
high school,
clothing.
Yes. I would not have been surprised.
I know. But, you know, they were also wearing corsets. Maybe they just needed some
just
air.
Just made them ordinary.
But I really learned about art acquisition. I learned, again, how we find objects and ideas and people that are important to us and how we hold them close, how we show them to other people. And one of her visions was really making art accessible to the public. And so I love that idea, and it's something that I hope is conveyed in the novel.
Do you like her? Love her? Indifferent? She was just...
This whole novel, The Lioness of Boston, is a love letter to the museum and a love letter to Isabella Stewart Gardner. I think she probably would have, at turns, you know, wanted to be my friend and also been, you know, cutting and said all sorts of inappropriate things. And that's probably what was so fun about her. I think she spoke her mind and was a pretty wild and individual person.
And she really did walk a pair of lions.
We don't know. There's a sketch of her in her full getup walking lions, and so that is definitely in the novel. How could I not put it in there?
All right. Emily Franklin, author of the upcoming book, The Lioness of Boston, which chronicles the life of Isabella Stewart Gardner. It comes out April 11th. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Amanda Beland and Rob Lane with Bart Tachi and John Bender. Marquise Neal is our senior technical director. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.